The first track on the left was wrong too. He found the right place on the second right-hand track. It was an overgrown driveway running away south, parallel with the river. It was an old rusted mailbox at the gate, back from when the postal service was prepared to come a little nearer your house. Same dull green color, but even more faded. Same neat painted script. Faded like a ghost. Hobie. There were power lines and a phone cable running in, swarming with vines that hung down like curtains. He swung the Taurus into the driveway, brushing vegetation on both sides, and came to a stop behind an old Chevy sedan, parked at an angle under a carport. The old car was a full size, hood and trunk like flight decks, turning the same pitted, dull brown that all old cars turn. He killed the motor and got out in the silence. Ducked back in and grabbed the stack of mail and stood there, holding it. The house was a low one-story, running away from him to the west towards the river. The house was the same brown as the car, ancient boards and shingles. The yard was a riot. It was what a tended garden becomes in 15 untouched years of wet springs and hot summers. There had been a wide path running around from the carport to the front door, but it was narrowed like a gangplank with encroaching brush. He looked around and figured an infantry platoon equipped with flamethrowers would be more use there than gardeners. He made it to the door, with the brush grabbing and snatching at his ankles. There was a bell push, but it was rusted solid. He leaned forward and rapped on the wood with his knuckles. Then he waited. No response. He rapped again. He could hear the jungle seething behind him. Insect noise. He could hear the muffler ticking as it cooled underneath the Taurus over on the driveway. He knocked again. Waited. There was the creak of floorboards inside the house. The sound was carrying ahead of somebody's footsteps and spilling out to him. The footsteps halted on the other side of the door, and he heard a woman's voice, thin and muffled by the wood.
"Who's there?"
it called out.
"Reacher," he called back. "General Garber's friend."
His voice was loud. Behind him, he heard panicked scurrying in the brush. Furtive animals were fleeing. In front of him, he heard a stiff lock turning and bolts easing back. The door creaked open. Darkness inside. He stepped forward into the shadow of the eaves and saw an old woman waiting. She was maybe 80. Stick-thin, white hair, stooped, wearing a faded floral print dress that flared right out from the waist over nylon petticoats. It was the sort of dress he'd seen in photographs of women at suburban garden parties in the 50s and the 60s. The sort of dress that was normally worn with long white gloves and a wide-brimmed hat and a contented bourgeois smile.
"We were expecting you," she said.
She turned and stood aside. He nodded and went in. The radius of the skirt meant he had to push past its flare with a loud rustle of nylon. "I brought your mail," he said to her. "Your box was full." He held up the thick stack of curled envelopes and waited.
"Thank you," she said. "You're very kind. It's a long walk out there, and we don't like to stop the car to get it in case we get rear-ended. It's a very busy road. People drive terribly fast, you know. Faster than they should, I think."
Reacher nodded. It was about the quietest road he'd ever seen. A person could sleep the night out there right on the yellow line with a good chance of surviving until morning. He was still holding the mail. The old lady showed no curiosity over it. "Where would you like me to put it?"
"Would you put it in the kitchen?"
The hallway was a dark space, paneled in gloomy wood. The kitchen was worse. It had a tiny window, glassed in with yellow reeded glass. There was a collection of freestanding units in muddy dark veneer and curious old enamel appliances speckled in mint greens and grays, standing up on short legs. The whole room smelled of old food and a warm oven, but it was clean and tidy. A rag rug on worn linoleum. There was a chipped china mug with a pair of thick eyeglasses standing vertically in it. He put the stack of mail next to the mug. When her visitor was gone, she would use her eyeglasses to read her mail, right after she put her best frock back in the closet with the mothballs.
"May I offer you cake?" she asked.
He glanced at the stovetop. There was a china plate there, covered over with a worn linen cloth. She'd baked something for him.
"And coffee?"
Next to the stovetop was an ancient percolator, mint-green enamel, green glass knob on the top, connected to the outlet by a cord insulated with frayed fabric. He nodded.
"I love coffee and cake," he said.
She nodded back, pleased, bustled forward, crushing her skirt against the oven door. She used a thin, trembling thumb and operated the switch on the percolator. It was already filled and ready to go.
"It takes a moment," she said.
Then she paused and listened. The old percolator started a loud, gulping sound.
"So, come and meet Mr. Hobie. He's awake now, and very anxious to see you, while we're waiting for the machine."
She led him through the hallway to a small parlor in the back. It was about 12 by 12, and heavily furnished with armchairs and sofas, and glass-fronted chest-high cabinets filled with china ornaments. There was an old guy in one of the chairs. He was wearing a stiff serge suit, blue, worn and shiny in places, and at least 3 sizes too big for his shrunken body. The collar of his shirt was a wide, stiff hoop around a pale, scrawny neck. Random, silky tufts of white were all that was left of his hair. His wrists were like pencils, protruding from the cuffs of his suit. His hands were thin and bony, laid loosely on the arms of the chair. He had clear plastic tubes looped over his ears, running down under his nose. There was a bottle of oxygen on a wheeled cart parked behind him. He looked up and took a long, loud sniff of the gas to fuel the effort of lifting his hand.
"Major Reacher," he said, "I'm very pleased to meet you."
Reacher stepped forward and grasped the hand and shook it. It was cold and dry, and it felt like a skeleton's hand wrapped in flannel. The old guy paused and sucked more oxygen and spoke again.
"I'm Tom Hobie, Major, and this lovely lady is my wife, Mary."
Reacher nodded. "Pleased to meet you both," he said, "but I'm not a major anymore." The old guy nodded back and sucked the gas through his nose.
"You served," he said. "Therefore, I think you're entitled to your rank."
There was a fieldstone fireplace built low in the center of one wall. The mantle was packed tight with photographs in ornate silver frames. Most of them were color snaps showing the same subject, a young man in olive fatigues in a variety of poses and situations. There was one older picture among them, airbrushed black and white, a different man in uniform, tall and straight and smiling, a private first class from a different generation of service, possibly Mr. Hobie himself, before his failing heart started killing him from the inside, although it was hard for Reacher to tell. There was no resemblance.
"That's me,"
Hobie confirmed, following his gaze. "World War II?" Reacher asked. The old man nodded, sadness in his eyes.
"I never went overseas," he said. "I volunteered well ahead of the draft, but I had a weak heart. Even back then, they wouldn't let me go. So I did my time in a storeroom in New Jersey."
Reacher nodded. Hobie had his arm behind him, fiddling with the cylinder valve, increasing the oxygen flow.
"I'll bring the coffee now," the old lady said, "and the cake."
"Can I help you with anything?" Reacher asked her.
"No, I'll be fine," she said, and swished slowly out of the room.
CD 6
Tripwire by Lee Child.
"Sit down, Major, please,"
Tom Hobie said. Meacher nodded and sat down in the silence, in a small armchair near enough to catch the old guy's fading voice. He could hear the rattle of his breathing. Nothing else. Just a faint hiss from the top of the oxygen bottle and the clink of china from the kitchen. Patient, domestic sounds. The window had a Venetian blind, lime-green plastic, tilted down against the light. The river was out there somewhere, presumably beyond an overgrown yard, maybe 30 miles upstream of Leon Garber's place.
"Here we are,"
Mrs. Hobie called from the hallway. She was on her way back into the room with a wheeled cart. There was a matching china set stacked on it, cups and saucers and plates, with a small milk jug and a sugar bowl. The linen cover was off the platter, revealing a pound cake, drizzled with some kind of yellow icing, maybe lemon. The old percolator was there, smelling of coffee.
"How do you like it?"
"No milk, no sugar," Beecher said. She poured coffee into a cup, her thin wrist quivering with the effort. The cup rattled in its saucer as she passed it across. She followed it with a quarter of the cake on a plate. The plate shook. The oxygen bottle hissed. The old man was rehearsing his story, dividing it up into bites, taking in enough oxygen to fuel each one of them.
"I was a printer," he said suddenly. "I ran my own shop. Mary worked for a big customer of mine. We met and were married in the spring of 47. Our son was born in the June of 48.
He turned away and ran his glance along the line of photographs.
"Our son, Victor Truman Hobie."
The parlor fell quiet, like an observance.
"I believed in duty," the old man said. "I was unfit for active service, and I regretted it. Regretted it bitterly, Major. But I was happy to serve my country any way I could, and I did. We brought our son up the same way, to love his country and to serve it. He volunteered for Vietnam."
Old Mr. Hobie closed his mouth and sucked oxygen through his nose once, twice, and then he leaned down to the floor beside him and came up with a leather-bound folder. He spread it across his bony legs and opened it up, took out a photograph and passed it across. Reacher juggled his cup and his plate and leaned forward to take it from the shaking hand. It was a faded color print of a boy in a backyard. Boy was maybe 9 or 10, stocky, toothy, freckled, grinning, wearing a metal bowl upside down on his head, with a toy rifle shouldered, his stiff denim trousers tucked into his socks to resemble the look of fatigues buckled into gaiters.
"He wanted to be a soldier," Mr. Hobie said, "always. It was his ambition. I approved of it at the time, of course. We were unable to have other children, so Victor was on his own, the light of our lives. And I thought that to be a soldier and to serve his country was a fine ambition for the only son of a patriotic father."
There was silence again, a cough, a hiss of oxygen, silence.
"Did you approve of Vietnam, Major?"
Hobie asked suddenly. Reacher shrugged. "I was too young to have much of an opinion," he said. "But knowing what I know now, no, I wouldn't have approved of Vietnam."
"Why not?"
"Wrong place," Reacher said. "Wrong time, wrong reasons, wrong methods, wrong approach, wrong leadership. No real backing, no real will to win. No coherent strategy."
"Would you have gone?"
Reacher nodded. "Yes, I would have gone," he said. "No choice. I was the son of a soldier, too. But I would have been jealous of my father's generation. Much easier to go to World War II."
"Victor wanted to fly helicopters," Hobie said. "He was passionate about it. My fault again, I'm afraid. I took him to a county fair. Paid $2 for him to have his first flight in one. It was an old bell, a crop duster. After that, all he wanted to be was a helicopter pilot. And he decided the Army was the best place to learn how.